Well, Gene Mangan, legendary Kerry cyclist, I'm delighted to be talking to you about your life and times. And first of all, let me say, when you were a young fella growing up in Killoglan, the bike was your constant companion, but it got you into a lot of trouble because you ran away from school, and the bike was your constant companion, wasn't it?
It was, yes. I ended up at 14 going to the Tech in Tralee, and my first racing bike, and I think everybody thought my father was mad, but he said, if it's bikes you want, I'll give you bikes, but you have to go to school. So if you're not going to school here, you can go to Tralee. And I think my life changed going across the mountain 17 miles each way every day, and the weather got better, and I'd come home by Annascaul, and it was the opening of a huge door for me, and all enjoyable.
We should let it be known, of course, before we delve into your career. 1955, Gene, you won the Ross Tarleton. You won two stages that year. You were the youngest winner at just 18, just 3 days before your 19th birthday. And your third stage win made you the youngest stage winner ever. Won two stages in 1956. You won the final four stages, four in 1958. And in 1964, won the first stage, Dublin to Carlow. And in 1966, Gene, you won the fourth, sixth and seventh stages. There's a lot more. But there's a great story when you were young, growing up in Killoglan, and you coming down the hill. Did you hit a cow or a horse or something?
No, it was just on the grove outside the town. I ran into a horse having my last sprint before I got home one night, and it was gone dark, and of course I had no light as usual. And it was a horse I ran into who was crossing the road, and I thought he was only winded, but apparently when the story got out anyway, they couldn't find the owner of the horse. The horse died because there was a question that I would be looking for a new bike. So we never discovered who owned the horse.
You actually killed the horse.
Oh, yes. I thought he only got winded, but apparently he did die, yes.
It's usually the other way around, unfortunately. Now, there's also a story about after Mass on Sundays when you would be showing off to the locals on the parapet of the Long Bridge.
Yes, I had... That was a lady's bike my mother had during the war, and it was a dare actually that you couldn't cycle on the bridge. And I started where the fishery is, and I rode along as far as James Coffey's bar where the Lone Rangers was founded. And I had to take that side because of the telegraph pole on the other side. What I found out afterwards was... I suppose there was a bit of a showman in it. They were just coming from last Mass, and it was noted that the tide was out as well. So it was a one-off, and that shows how fearless youth is.
Were you the first cyclist in the Mangan family, Gene? Or how did cycling come into your life?
Yeah. Oh, yes, I was the first cyclist. My grandfather was on the first Kerry team that played in the North Ireland and in the Munster, and he won five county championships. My father was the captain of a rugby club, a cricket club and a golf club, and won a Munster Cup with Tralee. So I came from ball players. And there was something about me that I wanted to go my own way anyway. And I think it was wheels that always attracted me, cars and motorbikes and things like that. And I had two boys who were cyclists then. But the present generation of grandchildren, we've gone back again. I have a grandson who won in All-Ireland last year now with Kilmacud Crokes, and another fellow playing rugby, and another fellow playing soccer. So after five, six generations, we're back into ball playing again.
How did you come to be picked in for Kerry in 1955 to race in the Ross Tarleton? And of course, all that era, which I remember growing up as a young lad, it was the golden era of cycling in this county. How did you come to be picked, Gene, and what are your memories of 55?
Well, I was a late choice because I was living in England at the time, and I only came home for the Ross, and I was a kind of the last man in, and as a result, I was totally unmarked. Now, I had ridden very well in England under an assumed name because, of course, we didn't have the proper licences. And
you were only 18 years age.
Yes, that's right. But I had ridden good times and ridden very well in England. And maybe a small bit of arrogance as well. I always remember being in a bike shop in England the week before I came to the Ross, getting a few things for the bike, and I bought two rolls of yellow tape with a view to putting them on the handlebars when I'd get the jersey. But I didn't tell anybody I had them till they had the yellow jersey, you know. So I suppose I had a good deal of confidence because I was riding well, but the fellas in Ireland didn't know about it because I wasn't riding under my own name.
Why was that?
That's because of this old issue of the division between the associations that existed for many years over 26 counties. And
what name were you riding under?
Aidan O'Shea.
Yeah.
And it wasn't uncommon, it had happened a lot of Irish fellas who were in England and raced in England, they didn't use the same name, you know, because theoretically we would have had to join an association that was in conflict with the NCAA, the GAA, that kind of thing. It wasn't that deeply rooted in my family at all, but it was very relevant in this time.
Because it actually came back to haunt you later on, which will come to you, finished up in jail in a foreign land over it. But who were your teammates in 55, Gene, and talk to us about the Ross itself?
Well, there was Paul Fitzgerald, who theoretically was unlucky maybe not to win the 54 Ross.
The Dingleman?
Yes. He was riding very well and was certainly one of the fellas that was marked for the 55 Ross. And it actually gave me great freedom to be wandering away up the road without being closely marked. Now, the following year, I was riding terribly well. And they were marking me, and Fitzgerald went up the road, you know. And I think it worked for both of us. He always felt that he should have won the 55, and all of us thought I was riding better when I didn't win the 56, you see. But that happens because of reputations and fellas marking fellas.
Something similar happened in 1969 All-Ireland final when Offaly put two or three different men marking Mick O'Connell and they forgot about Dinjo Crowley and he went to town that particular day. So it's something similar. And the rest of your teammates in 55, Gene?
Well, there was the late Jackie Connor and the late John Switzer, both from Tralee, and Callaghan, Paddy Callaghan from Cremorne, Killarney man, kind of Killarney man. And
how do you say kind of a Killarney man? Explain
well,
that to us.
Callaghan was from outside Killarney, and then he was in Killarney. And he worked in the mental hospital with the great Dr. Eamon O'Sullivan and Paddy Murphy. And he was kind of their political representative as well as cycling representative.
He was their protege.
That's right, yes. And then he came to Killorgan. He had worked in Killarney for a while as well, and he came to Killorgan then, and he had a bike shop here. And he met a girl that sat near me in school, and he married her, and then he came to Cremorne. And he went back into Killarney for a while, and then he went to Tralee, where he was a main opal dealer. And like Callaghan has had more lives than a dozen cats now.
I must explain to our listeners that you're great friends.
Yes,
Paddy,
we are.
Yourself.
Yes, we are.
Anybody else we're leaving out of that team?
I don't think there was anybody else in it. The later teams.
You won two stages that year, Gene. When did you take over the yellow jersey and what did it mean to you to pull it on?
Well, it was a great excitement for the whole team, which was managed by a marvellous man, Liam Brick from Tralee, and of course Jimmy Leahy. Our mechanic was Moss Cantlin, who's now in America. And we were followed by, we had an ESB van driven by Walter Dial, and on the motorbike there was the late Mick Gleeson. These were men who gave their time for the early Rosses out of their holidays and paid their own way. These were really the men that we forgot to thank.
So you can do it now.
Well, thank you all. I have done it since. When I lost my legs, I got very humble, and I did it indeed, yes.
Donny Shea from Killarney, Mackie Shea's son, his van was a well-known van around the roads too.
Donny wasn't in that one now. Donny was in a later group then when Murphy, that was the 56 Ross, Donny. Came. The 55 Ross was the SP van.
Yeah.
And again, you see, it's like the Kerry group. These were the people who put their time. Maybe it would appear in a small way, but it was a huge way when you think of the economy at the time. And they didn't think they were following winners. Like, it was a great surprise for them. It was as much of a surprise for us, of course, to win as it was for them.
When you pulled on tell us when you took the Ross Leaders yellow jersey.
That was the second last day I got away from the race leader, and I caught the breakaway alone, and then won the sprint into Wexford. So it was for that Kerry team to defend the jersey the next day. And it was done without exception. And you must also remember that in the 55 and 6 Ross, that was very obvious because we also won the team prize in those races. So you see, it wasn't one good rider. Like, they had 5 good riders. They produced 2 good riders who could win a Ross, and they've produced 5 men who twice won the team prize. So it was an exceptional...
It was a wonderful era into Kerry sport, Jean. Yes. When you crossed the line then to win the Ross that particular year, you were only 18 years of age. Did it dawn on you? We were too young to appreciate it.
You know, I always thought I was going to be great. But that's... You know the story about the Kerry man with the inferiority complex, as we all had when we were young. He thinks he's only as good as anyone else.
Mm-hmm. That was a great saying of John B. Keane's.
Yes, that's right. That's where it came from. Yes, yes.
So you were expecting yourself to win. Now, of course, it was the year in 55 when Kerry beat Dublin in that great All-Ireland final.
Yes.
And the sport was a boom in Kerry, the whole of the county.
Yes.
I remember it well. Now, ye got as big a reception coming home as any Kerry team has ever got. And to explain to our listeners, think of Kerry winning the All-Irelands in latter years and coming home. Well, that's what the Ross Tarleton team got that year. Isn't that right, Jim?
Yes. Well, that was a very interesting point you made there now. John Dowling was the captain that year. And I can remember it was the first year that they had the late Bishop Minehan trophy, which was a magnificent trophy, certainly the finest one I ever saw, about 3 feet. And the thrill of getting that the year that they won the All-Ireland was nearly bigger for me to be the Kerry man of the year with that trophy than winning the Ross.
You were chosen as Kerry Sports Person of the Year 1955, above all other sports.
Yes. And there was, I think there was a man named Downey in Tralee who was a handballer.
Paddy Downey was one of the greatest handballers the country has ever.
Yeah.
And that, Paddy, we send your best wishes, my friend. You listen to the programme every Monday night. Great fella, Paddy.
Yeah. He was the champion in another kind of sport where they had unsung heroes, you know. And he had a partner and he won both singles and doubles. And they were all there at that time. And there was a competitor, actually, a four-legged competitor who was my next-door neighbour, Spanish lad, who belonged to the late Chubby Connor.
Greyhound?
Greyhound. And, you know, Jerry McKinnon, these fellas, got Caltex awards. And I was more afraid of... I was more afraid of the Spanish lad than I was of John Dowling.
But the homecomings, Jean.
Oh, it was incredible.
And bonfires blazing
and
massive crowds coming out.
Yeah. Well, for me, it was a double one. There was a huge crowd in Tralee in the Ash Memorial Hall, and we got kind of a civic reception, and we came in to Tralee in McCown's truck up on the top of it. And then at some stage or other, you know, we kind of broke up, and I came to Killorgan, and Puck Fair had just started. And I was in the pub with my mother and father for the 3 days, and there was people coming to see me, the fella, the boy who won the Ross. And I'm sure it was quite obvious in my father's profit that year as well. So I had a kind of a double with it with the Puck Fair.
Yeah. I remember it well, Jean. It was a tremendous time, and it really kind of fashioned a lot of our lives. That era of the 50s was a golden era of Kerry sport. I just jump you on to 1958. You won 4 stages in a row in the Ross.
Yes.
Now, that was a remarkable achievement. You must have been absolutely flying. You must have been training very hard. Your body was in superb shape.
Yes, I had a very good year. I won 3 or 4 track titles. I wasn't normally a grass track rider at all, but I won 3 or 4 titles as well that year. And I won the 25-mile time trial championship, and won the 100-mile championship on the road. And I was riding better that year than any Ross I ever rode, but very, very carefully marked. And that was the Ross that both Dan Ahern and Murphy were on that team.
Mick Murphy, the Ironman.
Yes, and it was his first Ross. And he had ridden well, but we hadn't kind of seen him in multi-stage racing at all. He had ridden the Ross Moon that year and ridden very well, but I wasn't in it. But I remember Dan Ahern winning the first stage. And the next stage, Dan Ahern had the jersey, and Murphy went off, I think, on a mountain out of Waterford somewhere, and he was heading for Kilkenny. And Ben McKenna chased him, and I sat in Ben McKenna, and we got up to him, and I wouldn't work. I wasn't inclined to work with Ben McKenna, who later became a Ross winner as well. But we were both quite taken aback with the power of Murphy in the closing 10 or 15 miles. He actually dropped the two of us. And we were very taken back. And I was kind of making excuses that I had ridden very hard to get up to him and everything. But it was only then I realised that there was more in this guy.
This is Mick Murphy, the South Kerry man, the Iron Man, as he'd been
known. There was more in this guy than I had been told about, because I hadn't been racing against him. And the next stage then, he fell going into Glengariff, and I was in that breakaway, and I gave him my bike. Now, I would not have given him my bike if I thought he wasn't going to win the Ross. But there was a strength in him that was going to be there from day to day.
Was he different to every other cyclist, Gene? We're led to believe he was.
He was very different. He was different in personality. He was different in temperament. And he hadn't a cycling background like a lot of us. And he was a quite a shrewd fellow now. He had been around with the circus. And I remember him saying that we knew the end of bicycles, but we didn't know as much as he knew about his body. And he had been doing a lot of weight training, which wasn't the order of the day with us at all. And he had cross-country running, and he had worked in a circus, and he was doing strongman acts. And, you know, that all turned out to be true. And he had a very strange type of pedalling. He'd pedal very quick for so many revs, and then he'd stop. And he didn't rely on the bunch to sit in it. He would sit back off of the bunch, and he'd wait till it broke up, and he would ride then after him. He did an awful lot of lone riding, not good at tactics at all. And he had a very simple tactics. You kept in touch with the front of the race. And he was able to do that. He was able to physically go up after the leaders any time he wanted to. And he'd sit there off at the back of them, and he'd launch an attack. And if you didn't get him going, you wouldn't get him at all, because if he got up the road alone, he had this huge strength, very like that kind of strength that John Mangan had. Now, Ben McKenna had it as well. But these are the guys who don't rely on such tactics. They have strength.
But getting back to yourself then, to win 4 stages of the Ross, Gene, I mean, in any race, anywhere in the world, that is an extraordinary feat. And you looking back at it now, you still think, God, I was in great shape at the time.
I was, yeah. Actually, it was 4 of the 8 stages. It was 50%, you know. But I have to make a point too, of course, that there wasn't international riders in our event that year, and didn't come for another few years when the Russians and the Poles and these fellas came. And it's not something a very good rider could do so easily now. Now, the fields were smaller, 60, 70 riders. The races were longer, and there wasn't the same element of speed in them.
But you still could only beat what was put before you.
That's right, yes. That's
no matter
right.
what way you look at it.
Yes, well, you know the saying of the great Eddie Merckx. He said, as we got older, we thought we were greater than we were.
Well, that's a great way to be. And also, staying with 1958, you got a Celtics Award. You were awarded the special trophy. All the top sportsmen in Ireland got trophies. And Jimmy Keever got the football trophy from Derry. Yeah. Derry went to the final that year. They beat Kerry in the All-Ireland semi-final. And you got the Celtics Award. Yes. And you stood alongside some of the top sportsmen in this country getting that award. How important was that to you, Gene, looking back at it?
Well, it was. I remember the event very well. But I was in France when the dinner was on, and my father went. So I wasn't actually standing. But they had as many of us as lived for the 40th anniversary. And I was sitting between Freddie Gilroy and Tony Wall. Vincent O'Brien was in Australia. Eleanor O'Neill couldn't be found. She was in South Africa. Billy Martin had died. Sorry, it wasn't Billy Martin. He wasn't there. There was a golfer from Harry Bradshaw.
Himself and Christy O'Connor died, had won the World Cup.
The Canada Cup. He was dead. So there was only a few of us left. And the hurler and the footballer were in great shape.
Tony Wall and Jimmy Keever.
And there was the final fella then was a fella named Bertie Messett, who had gone to the Olympics. He was a marathon runner. He was in good shape. So there wasn't that many of us in great shape 40 years later.
There was a story at that time about Dr. Tony O'Reilly, who won the Rugby Celtics Award that year. That correct me if I'm wrong, I think he was told that if he took it, he could be suspended.
Well, yes, O'Reilly was a natural for it. He had that glorious period, and he had just everything. And as a result, these were lovely trophies, and the Rugby Union of Ireland told him that these trophies were worth more than £30, and he would be suspended. He'd be deemed a professional, and the nomination never went through. And it goes to show that the Brian O'Driscoll can earn £500,000 now, in the way the world changed. And it changed in the bikes the same way as it changed in that.
You were still going very strong, Gene, in 1966. Because you won the 4th, 6th and 7th stages of the Rostarlton.
Yes, yes.
Now, your career, how long were you cycling at this stage?
Well, I started racing when I was 14 and I stopped when I was 56, when my boys gave up and got married.
Yeah.
Now, I stopped racing when I was 56.
And what year was this?
That was, 56.
After 66, when you won the three, take us from there. You won the three stages in 66.
Yes. Well, I rode my last Ross when I was 41, and I got a very bad fall in it.
How many Rosses did you cycle in?
Well, I rode the first 80, and I rode the 25th anniversary, and I rode a good few of them in between. I missed one or two. I had falls and things. And I had a very bad accident. I was knocked by a car, and I broke my legs, and I have a mechanical shoulder and a remade wrist. When I was about 36 or 7. And I finished very serious racing when I was 41. I won the sprint championship from Seamus Kennedy, and I rode my last Ross. And then I went to the Veterans Association. It's a kind of a Walter Mitty association for fellas who don't want to go home and mind their children. And I raced in that till I was 56. And I had a very difficult decision at that time. My boys had been racing and they were giving it up. They were getting married and things. And my great friend Ben McKenna, Paddy Flanagan, Sonny Cullen, all fellas I had rode, they all got heart attacks around that time. And I said, you know, we must be careful trying to be the champion again. And I stopped racing and I just ride the bike a few times a week now.
We'll come to that. But what I want to bring you back to, you went to France. You cycled in France for a year, and there were circumstances arose there. You weren't happy with it because drugs were very, very flahool with at that particular time. They were taken as accepted in cycling, Gene, and I think that turned you off a bit. Talk to us about your year in France.
Well, I got a warning from my father about drugs, all right. And it was quite obvious when I went there that, you know, it wasn't something that was even hidden. It was just part and parcel of it. I would imagine it was rampant. But, I mean, I saw fellas taking them, and I knew in my heart and soul, you know, after that year, that you wouldn't be a world champion outside that circle. And it would appear, history shows us, that so many of the great champions, the really giants of the sport, they all died quite young. An awful lot of them died very, very, very
young. For instance?
Well, Anquetil, the four times winner of Tour de France, was dead nearly. He was 51. He was an advocate of drugs. He refused, even when the testing came, he refused to even be tested. And Bobe, so many of the greats didn't enjoy, you know, the fruits of wonderful careers. And, you know, maybe it wasn't something that just was in the Irish people at all. You know, we had a different attitude. Sport was sport for us. This was business. This was about money.
How did you find cycling against all the top men in France for the year you were there, Gene?
Well, it was very difficult. They had a very different way of racing because the big teams had the ability to dominate. They could do the chasing, and they would shelter their superstar, and he would be unleashed in the last mile, last kilometre of a mountain and things like that. It was very different. Now, it wasn't as extreme, I suppose, that time as it is now. Cycling now is dominated completely by the big, powerful teams and big money and fantastic organisation, but all these big teams still have a superstar. They nearly all have one, not one, might have two leaders. And the racing is about these big groups of professionals against each other. It's not like the sport we had. You know, the riders, they ride the bike, and the rest of the time they're lying in the bed and they're being massaged, and they reluctantly walk down to have their dinners. They have men to repair the bikes for them, and it's a different world. It's a different world.
Knowledgeable bike men and experts who I have great time for have often said to me that Gene Mangan could have won a Tour de France if he had pursued his dream. That you were an all-rounder, you had it all.
Yeah, well, I suppose I was an all-rounder, but, you know, I did better, actually. I had a job I liked for 35 years, and I met a very nice girl who turned out to be a marvellous woman. She reared 6 children on her own, and she's now in the process of rearing 9 grandchildren. And I don't think I could swap that for a Tour de France.
But, Jean, you're a bit modest about it. Do you think that you were fit enough, that you were good enough on the mountains and in the flat and in the sprints to win a Tour de France?
Well, you know, youth has dreams. You know, youth has dreams. I would have great regard for Roach and Kelly now, because the biggest difficulty they had wasn't altogether about improving and being better than all that. It was worming their way into the teams and being team leaders, English-speaking team leaders, in what was the outpost of professional cycling. They were not received with open arms. And I would have fantastic admiration for the way they politically dealt with becoming team leaders. Like, once you become a team leader and have a good team, you're in the possibility of winning the classics or the Tour de France.
Would you have been in that possibility?
Well, an awful lot depends on your ability to have good people skills and the ability to have the language and to befriend the right people. And you'd want to be a Cued Kerry man for it, really, yes.
Would you not consider yourself a Cued Kerry man?
Well, no, do you know a funny thing about that? When you're in Dublin, I say, that's another Cued Kerry man. I always think the real Cued Kerry man didn't leave Kerry at all. And we all went off there and lived. And they married the nice girls with the business and things. I think the Cued Kerry fellas were the fellas who stayed.
What about the Kerry man that finished up in Paris and finished up in jail because he was a cyclist? Talk to us about that, Gene.
No, actually, it was in Rome. After the 55 Ross Talton, yeah, the NCAA decided they'd send a team to Rome. Now, keeping in mind, I was living in England and had come from Kerry before that. I wasn't as well informed politically as well as in the cycling around Dublin, where the division was very serious. And I was asked to go to the World Championship. And we went, and we flew to Geneva, and we cycled across the Bernard Pass. And
who were your teammates?
A fellow named the late Mick Crystal, Harry O'Toole King, the late Bernie O'Brien, and an out of Ireland fellow named Seamus McGreevy. No, I think Seamus McGreevy and myself are the only two left. And we cycled down to Rome, and I was getting kind of worried from the talk that we might not be racing, you know. And we left Rome one morning, and we cycled out to the circuit on a mountain outside Rome. Frascati was the name of it. There were 150,000 Italians, wild Italians in it. And I noticed that the other fellas had no drinking bottles or food for the race, you know. And I'm sure they were kind of laughing at me, saying, this guy is really green, you know. I still thought I'd have a chance of riding. And a division was there, and it became very obvious. And there was a confrontation between Mick Crystal and one of the other team. And the police got involved, and there was a row. And I backed into the pits, and the row was all over, and they were taking them away. And the race was just about to start, and I got out, and I got up on my bike, and they were taking Mick Crystal away. And he shouted at me, "Follow Elliot." She Elliot was the champion of France that time, and he was riding in that race. And the race hadn't started, but I had my leg across. I was just ready to start, and fellas came out. And there's another one of them here, and I was carted off as well. Now, many years later, I got to know Elliot and that. And Elliot ended up with three Italians, and they jumped him all over the road, and he ended up fourth. He would never have beaten three Italians, because three against one, and when all the riders in the league equal. And it took me a few years to realise I was maybe lucky at that stage that I was taken away, because it was going to be a very hard job to follow Elliot, because he was there with a chance of winning that world championship.
Where did you spend the night?
In a very famous jail in Rome called the Regina Caeli. It's for hardened criminals. We were there a few days, actually, and we had a very funny episode in it. We were there, and it was a weekend, so there was no charging or anything till kind of Monday or whatever it was. I think it was a Saturday we started, and we were there Saturday night, and there was waiters came in three times a day, and they took our orders, you know, from a local cafe. God, we ate terrible well, and we were having the best of everything. And we were released on Monday. Mick Crystal was there for 5 days because he had hit a policeman who tried to stop himself and another fellow fighting.
You were gate crashing the race, is that right?
We gate crashed the race, yes, we did. And we had a green, white and gold jersey, and the Irish team, which was a mixture of North of Ireland fellas and Dublin fellas, they had a green jersey, and they were entered as Irlanda do Norte, You know, there was a lot of things wrong with that agreement, you know, when you'd examine it carefully. And as a result, we were released because we weren't being charged, but Mick was kept. And when we were getting our clothes and our money and everything back, they had deducted the cost of the food, the luxury food we ate. And we kind of went into rebellion about it because it was nearly all we had. And they said, oh, no, no, the state only pays for you when you're convicted. So it was a great shock. And Mick had 4 or 5 days. And for some years afterwards, Mick Crystal was fined. And for some years afterwards, the Italian ambassador used to look for the money from him.
Yeah.
Of course, it was never paid. I don't have to tell
were
you.
Were you escorted to the boat?
No, we weren't. We were the four of us were released to go our own way, and the lads waited for Mick, and I really had enough of it, and I got up on the bike and I cycled to the airport, and I had a return ticket, and I came home, and I had an uncle-in-law who was a chief superintendent of the police in Dublin, and I had been staying with him. And he was a very conservative man now. He was the adjutant in the depot. And by the time I got to Rathorn Road where he lived, it had been fellas from the press and the Times and everything, and he was...
It hit all the national papers.
It was, yes, in the front of the papers, yeah. Yes. And this man was irate now. You know, he was a man who had served in the British Army as an officer in the First World War. And he really had no great welcome for me at all. He thought that I should have been kept in jail, really.
And what about your own family, your parents? Well, how did they take to their son being landed in jail in Rome?
Yeah, my parents were Cumana Gaelers, and they died, as I always said, unrepentant Cumana Gaelers. Yeah. And the whole political thing wasn't... It wasn't in our house now,
I know.
And my mother persuaded me not to go back to England, and I came to Dublin, got a job in Dublin then. But politically, I would say they hardly understood. I'd say the people in Kerry wouldn't really have understood the full implications about the cycling, which was a very deep-rooted... which produced a lot of incidents in the following years as well now, you know.
Did I see somewhere where all this in Rome happened in front of the Pope?
Oh, yes, the Pope was present, yes. Yeah. Yes.
Did he say, good man, Mangan?
He did not, actually. unless you said it in Italian, I didn't hear him anywhere. But he was in the audience. It was Castel Gandolfo is in Frascati. That was his summer residence, so he would have been there, you know.
Yeah.
And
he was not his summer holidays, was he?
He was, yes. Yeah. Uh-huh. He was, yes. He was.
And he came out. He heard about this fellow from Clark, and it was going to cause trouble, of course.
I wasn't going to cause trouble at all. You see, I would have no kind of political background. At the time we're talking about, I hadn't even voted, you know.
I know, but you were just caught up in it all. Jean, I must ask you, we could talk about so many people, but I must put two names before you. John Mangan, the great cyclist from Killarney, no relation to you, and Paddy White from Castle Cove. Yeah. Just talk to me briefly about those two men, because our listeners would like to know what we're on about.
Well, Paddy White was more or less... leaving cycling as a competitor when I was starting. But I had ridden the 54 Ross with him. And he had, at that stage, won either 2 or 3 national 100-mile time trial championships. So he was well-known, not well-known in Kerry. I only remember him ever coming to Kerry to ride one evening race. His racing was in Dublin. He was in the Air Corps, and they had a team in the Air Corps. So he was racing in Leinster, and he was a roadman. Now, he had retired after the 54 Ross, so I didn't know very much about him. But he was the first Kerryman to win a national cycling championship. We had never had one before. There was a man in Tralee, Willie Lynn, I think was his name, who was a track cyclist, who was a very good cyclist, but he never won a national championship.
And Paddy White still comes down to the black shop, down to the South Kerry on holidays. I'd meet him there regularly. He's fitting well at the moment. Now, John Mangan, no relation to Gene, spend a lot of time in France, but another legendary Kerryman.
Well, John Mangan I would know very well. He came to Dublin to work as an apprentice in Unidair when he was 18 years of age. So from that time, for the next few years, he was a training companion of mine, and we were close. And I was with him the year he won the Ross. He wasn't picked for Kerry, strange enough, the year he was racing in France. And they decided that Batty Flynn, another Kerry man, would lead the Kerry team, and they felt that there'd be a lot of conflict between the two of them, so he wasn't picked. So John Mangan rode with another friend of mine, Seamus Egan, and we had a three-man team. We hadn't even a full team, and that's the Ross he won. So I was the backup rider for John Mangan, and we had a hard Ross. He was a great winner. He had come back from France to ride in it. He was well prepared. And for me, it was a great thrill to see another Kerryman win a Ross. And the fella that I had a lot of input to, I suppose, when he was young, till he got to the stage he knew more than me, which was also true, because he raced in France for a long time, very successful. And there was a very famous race in France that John Mangan won. The year the Olympics were in Moscow, the French national team came to Rennes, where John Mangan lived, in a final race before they went to Moscow. And it was led by a man named Finan. And John Mangan and Finan got away from everybody else. And they were away all day, a big long break when the two of them riding flat out, two big gear men trying to get rid of each other. And John Mangan won it. And Finan didn't win the Olympics, but he later won two Tour de France's. And I always remember John Mangan said this was a great day. It was a fantastic day. He said, it was such a day, I only had to steer the bicycle.
Yeah. Remarkable athlete, and he's strong and fit living back here. Yes. He's deeply involved, of course, in cycling, and a grand fella, John Mangan. Gene, what did it mean to you to be a Kerryman? You're living in Dublin now, of course, retired from your job, and you live in Dublin. You come back here to Killoughlin on holidays. What does it mean? What did it mean to you all your life being a Kerryman?
Well, where we're sitting here now, this is a site I bought 35 years ago, alongside my mother's, my sister's, on the verge of the town, looking down at the town I was reared in. I had always hoped I'd come back here. My wife is from Glenbey. And I always had this feeling that when I'd crossed the field bridge, I was coming home. And I'd say to my wife, isn't it great to be coming home? Now, my wife had been in school in Glenbey, and she was in the Loretto in Killarney, and then she was in Sign Hill, and she had worked in Dublin. And she said, really, she says, ye Kerrymen, she says, this is your Walter Mitty world, isn't it? So it's a kind of...
Beautifully summed up.
Yes, it's just a kind of... Now, my wife doesn't have that, because we're in Dublin where our children and grandchildren are. And she says that's where our home. And I come... at the moment now she's in Rome, and I'm here in Killarton, and I would be here 10 times in the year. This is where I like to come.
Gene, you can never say, and no one can ever say, who was the greatest Kerry sports person of all time. But to me anyway, and most people, Gene Mangan would be always up and around there when arguments are started and spoken about. Who was the greatest Kerry sports person of all time, either man or woman? In your life now, and going through your life, and when you're retired and everything, are you still perceived as a great Kerryman when you meet people? What does it mean to you to have been a great cyclist in life? Now, we're here now sitting in your home. I'm delighted to be and honoured to be doing an interview with you. What has it all meant to Gene Mangan?
Well, I must divert a small bit from the question. And there was, where I worked, there was a competition one time to do 1,000 words or something on the greatest Irishman. And I wrote 1,000 words on what I thought was, he was certainly my hero. I never knew him. I knew his daughters all right. And it was Tom Crean. And it didn't win the competition, which surprised me, to Tom Crean. But the book, The Unsung Hero, wasn't yet published at that time. But a man working with me said, I read that, he says. And he said, I couldn't believe the way you finished it. And I said, Tom Crean was the most famous Kerry man ever. And as the most famous Kerry man, he was naturally the most famous Irishman. That was the way I finished the article. He thought it was very arrogant. But my hero wasn't the cyclist, the football, it was Tom Crean.
Yeah.
It was, when you read about him, now I'd heard a lot about him and I was always fascinated by him and I knew the family. Jimmy Cable brought me to see his sword and his medals when I was quite young now, but fascinated me. In terms of the greatest sportsman in Kerry, I suppose there's always the generation thing. And you see, I grew up in a town where the Lone Rangers had the J.P. O'Sullivan. And for a period of my youth, the Champion O'Sullivan, as he was called, he was also the athletic champion of Ireland. And that was like the triathlons. He ran and he jumped. And I think you had about 10 events before you'd be the national
champion.
He was
Dr. Eamon O'Sullivan's
That's
father.
That's right, yes. So I grew up thinking that was the greatest one. And then, as I was younger, Joe Cahan came, and he was the man I'd hear about in the pub. And then in my time, Mick O'Connell came. And in terms of mystique and everything else, I didn't play football now. I thought the Mick-O was the pick-em. And I lived in Diggs with two Kerry footballers, the late Kevin Coffey and my best man, Tom Long, who was in Killarney. And I used to go to the matches quite a bit at that time because I knew the fellas on the team and the Sheehys, I knew them. And one of the things that fascinated me about Mick O'Connell was not his real style of football or anything, because I didn't play it and I wouldn't see it just like an expert, was the way fellas would intimidate him and pull him and push him and drag him, and that he never retaliated. I admired him for that, because that's very rare in the game of football, as we now see from some of the things that are happening in Kerry teams. He never retaliated, and he got, I remember, a Galway man, Frank Ivers, giving him
a tough time. Yeah.
And I admired him for that. So, they were my men. Yeah. They were the three, but they were generations, three
but
different times.
To the question I asked you was, how has your own greatness stood on you over the years? Has it opened doors for you? Are you still recognised when people say, I'm Gene Mangan, or this is Gene Mangan, the great Kerry cyclist?
Well, what's happened? Yeah, you'd get a bit of that, all right. But what's happening now, you see, is I've lived too long. I'm coming 74, and there's a whole generation of young people who didn't hear of me.
No, this is the reason. This is the reason why I'm talking to you, because they have to hear about you,
yes.
And not alone that gene, but Kerry people and people all over love hearing about these stories. So, listen to me, we could stay talking. There was a great book, of course, brought out about the Ross.
Yes.
A wonderful book. Talk to me about that briefly, because you can't even get it now.
Well, Tom Daly, who lives in Kentucky, is really a Kerry man. And I had a lot of interaction with him when he was doing the book, because I have documentation from the first day I cycled. I have 30 bikes of the great riders. I have a bike of Copey, Kelly, Roach. I have the bike of Bertie Donnelly, and many world champions. And I just am a hoarder. I have the bike I won the Ross, and I have all those. And I have all the photographs and the paper cuttings. And I often wondered why I was keeping, they'd say, the house is going to fall down, the attic's going to come down into the kitchen someday with all the stuff you have up there. And it was only when he was writing the Ross book I realised why I kept it, because it was one of the few people who had it all. And I had brought it up to date, because I would have been going with teams in the Ross, and last year it was around the Ross. So I was never away from it. And it was important to have them, because he wasn't a cyclist. He was a canoeist. And he did fantastic research. And it was a great pleasure for me to have all that stuff that he could go through. Mm-hmm. And it was so important that it was written, because we had a world champion at the end of the 1890s, Harry Reynolds, that's unheard of. There was the great Bertie Donnelly, who won 64 All-Irelands, and Frank Sullivans, who won 60 All-Irelands. There were so many of those men that there was nothing put into the hardback till Daly came along. And regretfully, Daly only did the Ross, which was a story in itself. But there was no real record, rather than going through the old newspapers trying to find them. And it was, I was glad that it was written while I was alive. It was important.
It's a wonderful book. Any regrets, Jean? Any sporting regrets in your racing life? Would you have liked to have done something?
No, I have no regrets. No, I have no regrets about anything. I suppose if I thought about it carefully, I'd say I'm a bit impetuous. But maybe it's part of the makeup. My father always said, if he hasn't temper, put him up in the stand and make a spectator out of him.
Yeah, he must have a bit of temper.
Yes. Yeah. And temper is a bit, you know, there's always a bit of temper if you're a footballer or a cyclist. Yeah. And when you get old, you say, it would be nice not to be so impetuous.
Yeah.
But is youth impetuous anyway?
It is, Jean. We're finishing up. When I visited you today, you were up on your loft here in the house, and you had four or five bikes, and you were changing the tires on one of them. You do 2 hours every day around the roads. But you were tinkering with the bikes up in your workshop, because you keep fit all the time.
I do. Yes, I was putting on heavy tires because the roads are in such a mess around Killorden here now. I can't believe they're so bad. They will have serious consequences for even fellas driving cars. They'll be punctured in wheels and rims and things. Very, very, very bad. And it is dreadful for the bike.
Who was the greatest cyclist that you ever heard about or seen?
Well, my hero, I suppose, was this man, Copy, whose bike I have. Copy died at 40 years of age, and regretfully, he was at the end of the day, he was known to be a substance user, and he was asked how much of it he used when he was quite old. He raced till he was 40 and died. He died a few days after racing. He said, I only used it when it was necessary. That was his answer.
What would you say to young people listening to us this evening in relation to picking up cycling and making a career of it? Why should they do it? What has cycling got above everything else?
Well, cycling is no different than football or anything else. If you try it and you get a buzz out of it and you enjoy it, no matter how much you enjoy it, there is still a fantastic feeling when you come in and stand under the shower. There's this fantastic feeling of well-being, even a day where you got a hammering. You'll get that if you like it, in any sport.
Jean Mangan, listen to me. It was great talking to you. You were my boyhood hero. You still are, and you always will be. Come here. You're a credit to Kerry. You're a great sporting hero. And thanks for taking time out to talk to me.
My pleasure. The Kerry Group Ross Moon. It's Friday, Saturday, Sunday and Monday. And it's the second oldest stage race in Ireland after the FBD Ross. Now, the origin of these races were, the original Ross was so successful that each provincial council decided they'd run 3-4 there, Ross. And there was a Ross Ulla, a Ross Connacht, a Ross Lyne, and a Ross Moon. And the only survivor is the Ross Moon, which started in the early to late 50s. And it has been run by different clubs in Munster over the same weekend over the years. And at the moment, it's been run by the Killorglan Cycling Club. And really, the Killorglan Cycling Club should be called the Killorglan and District Cycling Club, because the hub of the Killorglan Cycling Club is not in Killorglan town at all. It's above in Carnahone, where Michael and Mary Concannon are, and many of their volunteers, and their neighbour John Mangan, who's just down the road in Arlahas, who campaigned in France for 12 years and brought back a lot of expertise. And he's the chairman of this club that has lifted it to great heights and has given a long service in it to both the race and to the club. And then it's not totally run in this area at all. Tadhg Moriarty, who's from Listowel, is the race director. The secretary of that club is in Carsevine, where there's some up-and-coming riders who ride with the Killorglan jersey on them. And generally speaking, it's what you'd call a community. It's a community race. It's a community club, really. And there's the huge support then from Tralee, two and three generations of the Lacys, and the Killarney club. So it's really back to where we started in the early 50s. The club at that time was the Kingdom, and it had three Ross winners, but everybody was from a different part of Kerry. So that really still exists. It's a kind of a cooperation, and it is how Kerry was successful that the infighting never stopped the development of it in Kerry. Let me see.
There's riders coming from all over. Talk to us, Gene, about where they're coming from, because there's huge changes since your time in this particular Ross.
Well, there is, of course, because as years went on, Ireland became very desirable to the foreigners. The police cooperation, bigger crowds coming to see the races, the fellas in England and Europe in particular love to come to Ireland. Now, there's an awful lot of English riders would come here. They find it easier to race here, more cooperation. They find a lot more publicity and a more interest in the cycling than there is in England. The English people have taken over the roads to such an extent they don't want any cyclists in them at all, you know. And they're having awful trouble in England with police cooperation. Many of the big races in England have been banned by the police. They say there's no safety in them because of the traffic.
And it's the opposite here, because the Gardaí do tremendous work and all the other voluntary organisations down in Kerry in particular, Gene.
Yeah, everywhere, yes, that's true. But that's the difference between the two countries. There's 50 million people in England. And sport in England is cricket, where there's 40,000 clubs. And the rest of it is inside in soccer fields. There is nothing else. England has several world champions who are virtually unknown. You know, it's very much the Cinderella sport there. But it has never been covered in the newspapers like it's covered here. Like, they had a Tour of Britain last year and they're going to have it this year. The Ross Moon will have more coverage than it.
And where else will we see the riders coming from?
There's a few continental teams. They always keep that back from us till the thing is published. But I usually Dutch now. They're usually a good contingent to Dutch. And you won't have that many North of Ireland riders, because the Tour of the North is on, as it always has been in the North. There's another stage race up there. But you'll have any fellow who intends riding the Ross in it. This is a type of a race that it is necessary to ride this. You don't ride a Ross as your first stage race. You should always have a few stage races before Ross. They have a particular stage now starting in Killarney. And it's going up through Kilgarvan into Kenmare. And it's going across the bridge, up the Timhealy Pass, down into Glengariff, up the Tunnels Road, back into Kenmare, and up and finishing at the top of Miles Gap. That will be the first mountain top finish that we have ever promoted in Kerry.
How unusual is a mountain top finish? I know that in the big races, in the tours, and the big races in France, there it is done a lot. But I haven't seen them in Ireland.
No, they're new to us. This is our first time.
How exciting is this going to be?
It's very exciting because the people who have looked at the Tour de France in the television over the years, they don't start looking at it till they get into the mountains. And in the mountains, you see who are the men. Very little tactics, the pure riding. And the mountain stages are nearly always the winners of the event. And there is no doubt in my mind that that will be in Kinmare. That's three very hard climbs, a lot of tough road in 85 miles. Very little chance of recovering in between the climbs because it's short. And the road, like from the bottom of the Timhealy Pass into Glengariff, is a bumpy up and down road. Yes. Not a road you'd rode back into the back of the bunch if you were dropped.
Ty Moriarty pulled a masterstroke when he launched the Ross Moon from Miles Gap. I was above there that day, and it was a fabulous day. You could see forever from up there. Now, Gene, you're a great Kerryman yourself. We have a few great Kerrymen cycling in this, men that are quite capable of doing very well.
Yes, well, you have Eugene Moriarty, who was a grandson of the great Gene Moriarty, who was the county champion when I started cycling. And he has actually had 70 caps, 70 Irish caps. Like, he's in the class of O'Driscoll and these fellas.
He's a stallman now.
Yes, without the publicity that goes with the ball, all the ball, as it happens. And he's a past national champion. Then you have Paul Griffin, who's an ex-pro rider from Giant in Asia.
A Tralee man.
Tralee man, very successful. He's an ex-national champion. He was the only Kerryman ever to win a national hill climb championship. And then you have Sean Lacey, kind of a third generation.
Another Tralee man?
Yeah, a third generation of Tralee cycling family. Great supporters, kept it going for 50 years, it was three generations. And very unusually, for the start of a season, we're racing now for four Sundays, and he has won the four races every Sunday. This is a guy who has wintered well. Well advised, there'd be a cycling culture in the house where they always did their cycling well and were fantastic enthusiasts. So there's the three of them, and regretfully, these guys are in different teams. The commercial world rarely ever has all these fellas into one team. And if I had a dream, it would be that before I die, I'd see the likes of the three of them back in a Kerry jersey to win a Ross, to bring us back to where we started. And it is possible if that was done.
Now, let's stay with that for a second, for a few minutes, Gene. Of course, it must be possible. And it would be any Kerryman's dream, because Kerry people are very proud of their sportsmen and their sportswomen. In particular, the tradition of cycling in Kerry, the likes of yourself and the likes of John Mangan, the likes of Mick Murphy and Paddy Callan, all, you're all revered in Kerry in your own way. What would it take? What would it take to have a Kerry team in the Ross Tailteann now?
It would take it would take a sponsor in Kerry to say, I'm going to completely sponsor a Kerry cycling team with no outsiders. For the last few years, we have had outsiders because our riders were contracted into other teams. But it would be necessary to have a sponsor. And the people who are in cycling, I'm sure, would wish it as well. And that they go back into a green and gold jersey. You see, there is no such thing as just an ordinary club jersey anymore. Now, when you look at every football field in the country, they have a green gold jersey, but it's the Kerry Group on it. Even if you go to Mass, there's children in the Kerry Group jersey. This jersey deserves to be reintroduced. There's more green jerseys, Kerry green jerseys in Pug Fair than anything else. And it would take very little, but it would require a sponsor to put a rope around these boys and buy them in to the corral.
Well, if there are people out there, listeners tonight, Gene Mangan doesn't want to die before he sees a Kerry team, and that goes for us all. So, Gene, 4 days of great cycling coming up, the best cyclists coming to Kerry. What can Kerry people expect? What should they do? Why should they go out to view the cyclists as they whiz by?
Well, first of all, it's free. And there's always the excitement of the falls and everything that goes with it. And in Kerry, as it goes around Kerry, particularly Carsevine now, there's a cycling club there. The people who are interested in cycling over 60 years, they'll be around the place, you know. And it's great for the cyclists to see the crowd. The Ross Moon last year now in Carsevine, it was a great event. It was a great event. With buzz in the town and a lot of people there. So there'll be a lot of people in the top of Model's Gap. There'll be people at that. It's very hard to see a world champion. You can see them this coming weekend, or an Olympic champion. They'll be there. These are men who had these medals, who have won Rosses, and they're worth seeing.
Yeah, it's going to be a great event, and well done to all those people here, in particular, as Gene pointed out, in Kerry, who organised the whole thing. Of course, Radio Kerry will be keeping you well in touch with it all, so stay tuned in for the coming weekend, and you'll hear all about the Ross Moon.